Good afternoon. I'm KAZU General Manager Mick Benedek. Coming up, it's a special presentation of the Cal State Monterey Bay President Speaker Series with guest speaker Jamie Marisotis, President and CEO of the Lumina Foundation. But first, I'm joined in the studio by Cal State Monterey Bay President Dr. Eduardo Ochoa. President Ochoa, can you give us a bit of background on Jamie Marisotis and the work the Lumina Foundation is involved in?
Well, Jamie Marisotis is a national leader in higher education policy. And when he took over the helm of the Lumina Foundation, which is a $1 billion foundation exclusively dedicated to college completion, he really had a big impact on the national dialogue and the policy development for higher education. They were the first ones to lay out a challenging goal of by the year 2025 to have 60% of Americans holding high-quality degrees. This goal was so compelling that President Obama developed his own very similar goal for the year 2020. And it has really become kind of the dominant theme in higher education. They've also made some very important leadership moves in terms of achieving that goal, such as supporting initiatives like the degree qualification profile, which actually for the first time articulates what a student should know and do with a degree at the baccalaureate or master's level or associate level. And this helps us by articulating what students should be able to know and do. We are then freer to experiment on the input side, on the methods that we use to achieve those outcomes. They've also lately gotten involved in the issue of productivity and using innovative techniques and information technology to expand our capacity. And that's why that's where there's a direct connection to the theme of the President's Series.
President Ochoa, it's my understanding that Jamie Marisotis and the Lumina Foundation are committed to increasing educational opportunities among low-income, minority, and other historically underrepresented populations, which is also one of the core missions of Cal State Monterey Bay.
Absolutely. They understand very well, very clearly, that in order to achieve this ambitious goal for the country, we're going to have to educate a much larger proportion of underrepresented minorities, including the ones that we serve here at CSUMB.
In just a few minutes, we'll hear Jamie Marisotis, guest speaker of the third and final presentation of this year's CSUMB President Speaker Series. Do you have any thoughts or feelings on how this year's series went?
Well, I think we've gotten a great overview of some of the changes happening in higher education. We heard earlier from Candace Steele and the work that Carnegie Mellon has been doing for a number of years, really doing some deep research into how learning takes place and how we can develop adaptive information technology tools that can customize education for students. We've also heard from the founder of Udacity, who really set higher education on fire with the development of MOOCs, the massively online open courses. And now we're hearing from Jamie Marisotis, who's going to give us a broad overview of the new developments in higher education, many of which this foundation has been at the forefront. I should also add before we break that We already are the recipients of a $500,000 grant from the Lumina Foundation to support our Student Success Initiative in partnership with a couple of other institutions here.
Now, here is this year's final Cal State Monterey Bay President Speaker Series with Dr. Ochoa interviewing Lumina Foundation President and CEO Jamie Marisotis. Dr. Ochoa starts by asking him for an overview of the Lumina Foundation and its priorities.
At Lumina, we've taken a sort of proactive model to philanthropy, and in our model, we believe that we have a responsibility to lead, and this responsibility comes from having a large amount of assets, but also from having a lot of expertise that comes from the tremendous network of partnerships that we've developed. So, helping the country mobilize to get to that goal, and then catalyzing the change by helping to design and build that 21st century system has become the main focus of our work.
Great. So, in your work with starting out with the goal of increasing completion and college attainment, you found yourself needing to focus your attention on issues of quality.
Yes.
Because as you explained to me once, you know, if we're going to create forces that are going to create pressure to increase the number of graduates that we produce, unless we focus on quality and we get a fix on that, it has the potential of having the negative consequence of lowering quality in the quest for numbers.
That's right. You know, there's an easy way to get to these goals, right? Which is you lower the standards, you produce a bunch of cheap credentials, and you say, well, we've gotten to the goal. That's not the point. The point is that what society really needs is talent, and that talent has overwhelmingly talent that has to be developed in post-secondary learning context in higher education. So our societal demand for talent is increasing, and that demand for talent has to be articulated in credentials, in the degrees and other credentials that we produce in higher education. So what's behind those degrees and other credentials is very important. The learning that's represented by them, the quality of the instruction, the ways in which we can know that students know and are able to do certain things with these degrees, that's really critical to getting to that goal. And it's one of the reasons why at Lumina we've taken such a proactive approach to helping better define what degrees actually mean, what's represented in these credentials, and helping to better understand what our role is in higher education in helping country develop that talent base that's so critical, not just to our economic well-being, but our social well-being, our cultural well-being as a nation going forward.
And in the process of doing that, you commissioned a document that is having quite an impact on higher education right now, the Degree Qualifications Profile. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
So the Degree Qualifications Profile was an effort to articulate in a simple framework, in a simple document, what competencies should be represented in an associate degree, a bachelor's degree, or a master's degree, irrespective of the field of study. So what's really behind the DQP is an effort to describe those competencies in five key areas that have to do with knowledge and skills and other types of capacities, integrative knowledge, in ways that actually will matter. In other words, the ability to demonstrate these competencies should be clearly articulated at each of those levels, and whoever is the recipient of these credentials actually knows what the credential represents. The reason why that's so important, I think, is that in American society today, we really don't have a common understanding of what degrees or other credentials actually mean. By that I mean that really the only thing that we know about an associate degree is that you, in most cases, have to accumulate 60 credits to get it. And a bachelor's degree, 120 credits. But the question is, what's behind that? Now, we have accreditation, which plays a very important role. We have standards within individual institutions, but we do not have a common understanding of what those degrees represent. So being able to better articulate what those qualifications actually represent is terribly important to us as higher education and as an American society. So the Degree Qualifications Profile is a tool, and the tool is being used, as you said, in a growing number of campuses across the country. At last count, roughly 230 institutions were beta testing this Degree Qualifications Profile, trying to figure out how they can actually use the tool to better describe the degrees on their campuses. And we're getting lots of feedback on the utility of the tool, what's missing, what should be added, which elements are really important. But I think the most important part is that there's a conversation taking place on individual campuses and across campuses now about what degrees actually mean. And that is what's ultimately most important to us at Lumina Foundation. If we have this demand for talent, the demand for talent has to be in post-secondary learning contexts, and the degrees are the way in which we measure the talent, we've got to be clear about what's behind those degrees. The DQP is a way of doing that. It's also a useful tool, in my opinion, for bringing campuses together to have these broad conversations. True engagement of faculty, which I believe really very strongly in, that the engagement of faculty is critical in these conversations, but bringing all of the constituents together to actually have a conversation and describe how is what we're doing on our campus actually articulating these competencies. That's what's really most important about the tool.
And so the DQP does this articulation of what a degree implies for the degree as a whole.
Right.
But you also have a companion effort that you've supported in multiple states called Tuning. And what's that about?
So we actually began with Tuning, and Tuning led to the DQP. Both of these have their roots in what's happening in other parts of the world around many other nations being able to describe what's behind the credentials that they award. Tuning's a process that was begun in Europe more than a decade ago, where within disciplines, faculty actually try to describe, again, those competencies, those reference points for the learning that's represented in the degrees that are awarded in those disciplines. What's different about Tuning, if you think about the degree qualifications profile as a way of articulating these sort of generalizable competencies, so the DQP applies irrespective of field of study, Tuning is a way of articulating those competencies at the discipline level. And the process of Tuning, I think, is really, really valuable. What we've seen in the growing number of institutions that are using it, as they've seen in Europe, in Latin America, in other parts of the world where they're doing Tuning, is that faculty are gaining a sharper understanding within their discipline about what their credentials actually mean. The way they do that is a pretty simple process, which is that they actually survey employers who are employing the students who have those credentials, and they talk to recent graduates, and they ask them about their skills and experiences, et cetera. And the faculty then come together and try to articulate, again, these competencies, these reference points for what should be behind the credentials. This has been very well utilized in certain states and certain disciplines, Kentucky and Indiana, Utah, and some other states. But now we're starting to see Tuning being used at a broader discipline level. So the American Historical Association is now attempting to tune history on a national basis as a discipline. And we think that the engagement of faculty in this conversation, much as I mentioned in the DQP, is very, very important part of this work to increase attainment in the United States. Increasing attainment, getting to that 60% goal, helping meet society's demand for talent. We have to make sure that faculty are a key participant, a key player in those conversations. I have to say, with all candor, that my concern is that many of the reform efforts in higher education in the last 30 or 40 years seem to have forgotten faculty. And I think that's a mistake. I think it's a mistake for many reasons, not the least of which is the faculty are the people who are closest to the learners. And so being able to better engage faculty in what I think is a broadly understood need to transform what we do in higher education to serve more students better, I think that engagement of faculty is really important. I have a receptive audience, apparently. So.
Yeah. So as long as we're on that note, let me allow you an opportunity to be explicit about why you think it's important that we achieve this attainment goal.
Well, I think there are many reasons why increasing attainment is important. I think that the economic arguments have become dominant in the last few years, and we've certainly contributed to that discussion. The simple fact is that to be an effective participant in the modern economy, you need a post-secondary degree or a post-secondary credential of some form in order to be a part of the middle class. With two-thirds of the jobs being created requiring some form of post-secondary education, you have to have that post-secondary credential. So you look at all of the data, the historic data, about the nature of work and how much work has changed in the course of the lifetimes of most of us in this room, you can see that work has evolved to a point where so much of what we do in American society requires those post-secondary level skills and knowledge. Getting to that attainment goal isn't just nice, it's necessary. It's critical to our economic future as a country. At the same time, the arguments for higher education never have been solely about economic outcomes, nor should they be going forward. They should be about our ability to be effective participants in a democracy. They should be about being able to be leaders in our family and in our communities, et cetera. All of those things are really important. But the economic factors have a great degree of urgency. Our inability to educate a lot more people comes at a cost. It comes at a cost to us in terms of our international competitiveness, where many of our competitors are now exceeding us in terms of their attainment rates. And it comes at a cost of our collective well-being as a society, because if we don't increase the attainment rate, our overall quality of life, irrespective of what's happening in other countries, is going to go down. So for lots of reasons, I think the importance of higher education, of post-secondary talent, is incredibly important, has never been more important in the history of our country. But now I think we have a real sense of urgency that getting to that attainment goal is too important for us to see the changes that are necessary as marginal or as things that can naturally evolve. We've got to catalyze those changes. We've actually got to stimulate the change and move as quickly as we can to a different system of higher education. The other thing that I'll add to this is that when we say higher education, we're now talking about something different than we were just a few years ago. With learning increasingly being democratized, not just because of technology, but because of lots of things about our understanding about how people learn and cognitive science and the rest, I think we have a better understanding here that these post-secondary skills, these talents that we expect, can be gained in lots of different ways. They can be gained in the military. They can be gained in workplaces. They can be gained through online means, in technology, et cetera. That merely, in my view, increases the urgency for us in higher education, for people in higher education institutions, to embrace this, to wrap our arms around what's happening in the rest of the world, because we are, in my view, going to continue to be the arbiters of quality, and we're going to continue to be, I think, the agents that are awarding those credentials. So we've got to figure out how we incorporate that into what we do, and we've got to make sure that what's happening in those other learning contexts meet a very high standard.
So you don't think that the so-called disruptive innovation that people claim is happening in higher education, you know, most visibly by things like MOOCs and for-profit startups, but in other ways as well, you don't think that's going to, some people have predicted that universities were, most of them were going to vanish, you know, in a couple of decades.
Yeah. I find it unlikely that universities will vanish. Universities as we know them today will probably be a lot different in a couple of decades than they were before. And I will say this about MOOCs, and I've said this before publicly. I see MOOCs as part of a point on the timeline of a continuum of change that we're seeing in higher education. MOOCs are not going to change higher education on their own. I think MOOCs are an interesting development. They are doing some things differently in terms of serving large numbers of students. But we've seen all kinds of transformations happening in higher education over the last two decades. And MOOCs are just one part of the timeline of those changes. I don't think MOOCizing the system is going to create our 60% attainment goal, nor do I think that 10 years from now we'll be seeing MOOCs as the dominant model. We'll see them as part of that continuum of change that's valuable and useful. But where we're getting at is, or where we're getting to, is that disruptive change happening from many different vantage points now. Many different things are creating the change possible. MOOCs are merely one element of that.
Right. So if you were here for our last speaker, Sebastian Thrun, you know all about MOOCs, but otherwise, if there's a few people in the audience who don't, MOOCs are the massively open online courses that are enrolling tens and hundreds of thousands of students from across the world. And for the most part, are not being offered for credit, although some of them are starting to be offered for credit. In fact, the American Council of Education has long had a Of course, you know this very well, but just for the benefit of our audience, the ACE, the American Council on Education, has provided a service where they have evaluated, especially for military personnel, experience that people have, and given recommendations about awarding credit for those things. And they were going to put that apparatus that they have to work on a limited number of MOOC courses that they were going to endorse or recommend as worthy of credit. And some institutions would presumably go along with that recommendation. So now here we have this very challenging goal. Obviously, it's going to, if we're going to go from 40 to 60%, it's going to require a substantial increase in capacity of our higher education system. The Obama administration has been doing its part by dramatically expanding the Pell Grants and by offering 100% direct student loans. But at the same time, we've been seeing this pretty substantial disinvestment in higher education by the states, who've been the traditional funders of public education. And public higher education is responsible for awarding nearly 80% of the post-secondary credentials. So the question to you is, what can we do about that capacity challenge?
So I think this gets to that second imperative that I mentioned, which is, how do we design and build this 21st century higher education system that's actually going to meet our needs and get us to where we need to be? All of this effort around mobilizing those various actors to do something, to actually create the change, is very, very important. But we've got to create a series of changes. We have to do so, again, with some haste in order to be able to get to that goal. So let me mention a couple of the areas where we need to create that much different system. The first is you mentioned Pell Grants and student loans as examples. The student finance model in American higher education today is broken. That system simply no longer meets the needs that we have as higher education. It no longer meets the needs of students and their families. It no longer meets our societal need. The debt levels are too high. Tuition systems and the ways in which we allocate resources are too complex for any normal person to understand. And so we have a real mess on our hands in terms of student finance. I say this as someone who is a first-generation college student, first-generation graduate, Pell Grant recipient. I describe myself as a walking advertisement for every student financial aid program ever invented. I'm the beneficiary of so much of society's, not just governments, but society's largesse. I benefited from the fact that society cares about people like me, and my church, my state, my community, the federal government, and the college that I went to all contributed to my success. That model has served us extremely well. But the problem is, our ability to actually sustain that model and get to the 60% goal is highly unlikely. And the fundamental reason is that the two forms of resource constraints that are upon us are essentially countervailing forces. You can't deal with increasing capacity when you've got such strong constraints. The first one is the constraints that governments face. Those constraints are real. Even under the most rosy, optimistic scenarios, an expectation of massive influxes of new government money, be it state or federal, is really unrealistic. Can governments do more? Maybe in some cases, maybe not in other cases, but I think the prevailing view is that governments are constrained. At the same time, the other major source of revenue, students and their families, they're also constrained. The constraints that we see in terms of student debt, the constraints that we see in terms of decision making that's based on the sticker price as opposed to the outcomes that people expect of their higher education institutions, that's very real. So historically, what we did as higher education was, in times when government's resources were constrained, that's okay, we'll raise tuition. In times when government's resources were pretty good, well, we'll keep the tuition levels pretty moderate. And so these were sort of balancing acts. Well, now both are so constrained that the pressure on the system has become way too much. And what's happening is, places like California, you're literally seeing massive capacity challenges, right? You have this very high demand and an inability to meet that demand because of those capacity challenges. So fixing the student finance model is really, really important, and it's urgent. Related to that is essentially fixing the business model, which is how we actually manage higher education, how we deliver higher education. All of that is terribly important. And you know, we talked about technology. That's one important element of it, certainly not the only one. It has to do with our governance structures. It has to do with our productive capacity as a higher education system. That's really important. And then the other area where this change is urgently needed is really thinking about the credentials and actually what credentials we actually award. The conversation that we were having a few minutes ago about quality is really important, not merely because of the fact that we need to better understand what's behind these degrees, but also because it's not clear that the current set of credentials that we award are the right set of credentials. The magic of an associate or a bachelor's or a master's degree may no longer be in front of us, right? The fact that those things played an important role in American society for much of the 20th century may not serve us in the 21st century. So what should those credentials be? What should they look like? What should be behind them? There's a high degree of urgency behind that. Several things that I think are going to be important, not only in being able to clearly articulate the learning that's behind those credentials, the quality that's there, but it's going to be very important to also be able to understand the stackability of those credentials, our ability to actually accumulate knowledge over time so that one level of knowledge should naturally lead to the next level. So this whole issue of credentials, which I think sounds like an abstract conversation, but in fact is very real from the perspective of students and their families that are trying to make choices. It's very real from the perspective of employers who are saying we need more and different things than what we're getting out of higher education. I think this issue of credentials is going to grow very rapidly in our national debate.
So that touches on, I mean, I guess the real nexus there, or the area where this becomes critical is at the point where there have been in the past a bifurcation, right, in the paths the students take at the toward the end of high school, the beginning of community college, if that's where students are going. And so now I certainly what you're saying resonates with the idea of having a single path and common core standards for high school students, for example, that can prepare them for both careers and for further post-secondary work.
The other element of this is that if we're going to get to this 60% goal, our ability to get there cannot rest on the traditional pipeline of students graduating from high school and going to some form of post-secondary education. We literally don't have the numbers to be able to get there. So if you break down the numbers, which would be really boring in front of all of you, but if you break down the numbers, what you'll see is that we need to get actually more people through to the credential who are adults than we do traditional age students. So our ability to effectively serve those students over the age of 25 and make sure that we are delivering higher education in ways that are timely, useful, convenient, valuable to them is really, really important. And to go back to my example of the student finance structures, the student finance structures are highly disconnected from the reality of those adult students, right? Those models we're talking about, they were designed predicated on the idea that the typical student graduates from high school, goes to college the next year, and in many cases, if you think about the origins of the Pell Grant program, even student loans, it assumed that they were going to go to a residential four-year institution. Well, students in residential four-year institutions graduating from high school, that's about 15% of the students we serve in American higher education today. So the model no longer serves our needs.
So another issue, well, let me go back to the DQP a little bit, because I'm not sure everybody knows just how much that was an effort, an initiative on your part that didn't come out of the blue. It was definitely an American sort of response to very remarkable developments that happened in Europe and something called the Bologna process.
Right.
I was really struck by the, you invited four very remarkable and respected individuals to to draft that report with very different perspectives, with strong views.
Yes.
How did that go?
The documentary about their meetings would be award-winning, I think, because they really beat each other up for about a year. It was quite extraordinary. Carol Geary Schneider, Cliff Adelman, Peter Yule, and Paul Gasson, four people with deep, deep knowledge of learning and the outcomes of higher education, coming together and actually trying to describe these competencies was extraordinary. But the work that they did, I think, is reflective of what needs to be done. They stuck with it. And they hammered out what they saw as the best possible options. And we're now using the DQP as a beta. We don't think we have it right. We think we got it to a point where it was worth testing. And that's what's been done over the last 2.5 years with the DQP. And I want to go back to your point about where this really came from, because it is true that the Bologna process is part of the origins of the DQP. It's certainly where tuning came from. It came from Europe. But this idea of qualifications frameworks is really a global phenomenon. Many, many other parts of the world have these systems where you can describe the qualifications going all the way back to elementary school, preschool, and what students should know and be able to do all the way up through graduate level degrees, and then how those align with things like workforce outcomes, et cetera. This has actually been part of what you've seen in other parts of the world for an extended period of time. I first figured this out not from my own experience in Europe, but in my prior life when I was running the Institute for Higher Education Policy. We were working in, one of the places we were working was in Southern Africa. And I was in South Africa, the country of South Africa, during the time when they were developing their qualifications framework in South Africa, post-apartheid South Africa. And this was an extraordinary thing to see, a country going through such tumultuous change, to see them actually go through this very rational conversation about, okay, well, now that we're on the other side of the, you know, the dark part of our history, what should our higher education system actually be producing in terms of these qualifications, and how is it going to meet our societal needs? And again, it's not just economic needs, it's broader societal needs. And I realized coming out of that and some of the other places where I had seen it, that in fact, we were really one of the only countries in the world that hadn't done that, that hadn't actually gone through the conversation of saying, what does this degree actually mean? What should it represent in terms of learning? And how can you tell? And so the DQP is, if nothing else, an effort to stimulate that national conversation so that we can actually better articulate what degrees mean.
And one aspect of it that I should point out is that, and this may have been part of the, the strenuous dialogue that took place between the writers, is that unlike many of those other frameworks, we don't have a single prescriptive set of standards embodied in it, but rather truly a framework that sort of identifies dimensions along which a degree could develop or exist, so that in fact it's a space. It's a multidimensional space where the dimensions are well defined, and each institution can find its point in that space depending on how it chooses to emphasize different different dimensions.
That's right. And a very important point to add to that is that the DQP is agnostic about how you measure those competencies. In other words, it doesn't describe the assessments. It doesn't say, in order to be able to determine whether or not X competency is present, you should measure it through Y tool. That's one of the lessons I hope we will have learned from the efforts around K-12 reform, which is that in K-12 reform, my view is that we started the conversation with the assessments and then tried to figure out the standards afterwards. It makes no sense, right? Mm-hmm. So what we've got to figure out here is what, in a general sense, should these degrees mean? Then let's have the conversation about the variety of ways, whether it is portfolios, whether it is performances, whether it is a test, what have you, that you can measure those competencies. The form should follow the function here. And I think if there's one thing we should learn from what happened going back to A Nation at Risk in 1983, let's not start with the assessment and then figure out what the assessment should be measuring later. Mm-hmm. Let's start with a better understanding of what our degrees should actually mean, and then let's have that conversation. Obviously, these things happen on sort of parallel tracks, mm-hmm. but let's make sure that the tools are not what's driving the conversation. What's most important is what are those competencies.
So I got a couple of two more items that I want to touch on before we break off for questions. One is the issue of performance funding, which is very much on our minds right now because in a recent LA Times story, it was leaked that Governor Brown is currently in the process of developing a proposal for basing at least part of the funding for the CSU and the UC and the community colleges on performance funding. What's your sense about that? In particular, let me just mention some of the features that I think are, you know, maybe I shouldn't say this because I haven't read the story and maybe I know more than I'm supposed to know. Let me ask your general thoughts on you know, what are good and bad ways of doing performance funding?
So we've learned a lot about performance funding. Actually, going back more than a decade, performance funding is not a new idea. We're actually on essentially the second wave of performance funding in a way. There was an earlier wave that we saw in a limited number of states in the 1990s, but we're seeing a different model today. I think that the one of the fundamental questions you've got to ask is, what kind of performance do you want? That's a sort of a fundamental question. In other words, what are you trying to measure? And I think too often these policy conversations get diverted in these highly simplified measures, like a single graduation rate measure as the primary indicator of performance. Well, that doesn't make sense for lots of reasons. Graduation should matter. Graduation is certainly an element of the equation. But what student population are you serving? What fields are they actually getting those credentials in? And are those fields valuable fields? In what ways are you differentiating for the mission of the institution, which is something that you often don't see in these performance-based funding models? So I think a better way to think about it is to use the language of CSU Monterey Bay. What kind of outcomes do you want? And what kind of outcomes-based funding should you actually put in place in order to be able to allocate resources in a way that encourages greater outcomes on behalf of the institutions, but more importantly, ultimately, on behalf of the students. So figuring out these weighted, mission-differentiated performance-based funding models, I think it's going to be very important. I won't weigh in on what California should do specifically, except to say that I think that California is like many other states in that it recognizes an increasingly resource-constrained environment, and what it's trying to figure out is how to rationally allocate resources in a way that maximizes the use of those resources. But performance funding should not be used for two things. The first is as an excuse to decrease support. That's one real danger that you see in performance-based funding models, which is that it becomes a rationale for actually lowering the allocation of resources for higher education. My view is performance funding should make sure that the resources that we do have are allocated in the best possible way to achieve the best outcomes that serve those students and that serve the state. The second thing you don't want to have happen with performance-based funding is to have the conversation be about budgets, formula, or the sort of mechanics of funding as opposed to what you want out of higher education. So performance-based funding is a means to an end. The end is high-quality learning, high-quality outcomes for higher education that matter to the state's social and economic well-being. That's the eyes and the prize that you've got to stay focused on when you have these conversations about performance-based funding. Not should it be 2% or 10%, should it be, you know, how much does CSU get as compared to UC? Those are the wrong conversations.
Thanks. Well, I should mention that, you know, your while you have a narrow goal, you are supporting and advancing, helping advance that goal in multiple ways, in many dimensions. And one of them is helping us here. So I want to acknowledge and thank Lumina Foundation for having awarded us a $500,000 grant on the MSI Models of Success.
We are delighted to be your partner, and if I could just say a word, we are very impressed with what the Center for Teaching and Learning Assessment has done. We're very pleased with the work that's happening, and it's really hard work to try to rethink things like remedial education delivery in math and English, particularly in writing. So those things are really, really important. But that's a part of the fabric of what I was talking about, which is that the way in which you get to the change is you get to the point of delivery and you get better outcomes at the point of delivery. That's the way you can get scale and get to these big, hairy, audacious goals that places like Lumina have set, is to actually make sure that you engage people at the level where the change can really happen.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Let's give him a hand. And we'd like to open it up now to questions from the audience. We have microphones on both sides here, and please feel free to go up to one of them and ask Jamie Mirasotis a question.
Don't be shy. Yes, we have one right there.
Yes. I can yell. So at CSU Monterey Bay, we are an institution that's dedicated to, you know, serving the population of California, including first-generation low-income students. And a lot of our students, come to us with a lot of educational needs that have not been fulfilled when they get here. And so as we look at some of these innovations like MOOCs and online education and things like that, we're thinking that maybe they don't work as well for all populations. So I was wondering if you looked at that and what you want to say about that.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to say anything new that you don't know, which is that people come to higher education with lots of different experiences. Some have tremendous prior educational advantages, some have less, and people learn in different ways. And so both of those things are very important for us to take into account as we think about these dramatic efforts to increase attainment. To put it a different way, the populations you're talking about are the populations that we need to put our thumb on the scale of in order to be able to get to these goals. We simply can't get to these goals unless we emphasize Latino educational attainment. We can't get to these goals unless we emphasize adults, particularly certain populations of adults in areas where they've been poorly served. So you can go through this whole set of lists, veterans, returning veterans, hugely important population of students to be served in this country. But they're coming with prior experiences that can both add value to what's happening in the higher education experience, but also deficiencies that have to be addressed. And the point is, treating everyone with a one-size-fits-all model doesn't work. That's why the kind of efforts around things like what you're doing about rethinking remediation are so important, because what you've got to do is engage the learner where they are, not where you think they should be. I think that's just a critical part of the redesign process going forward.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you.
You left off talking about working on a grassroots level, pardon me, and also the Center for Teacher Learning Assessment. And I'm very curious in terms of being able to utilize some of the e-tools and some of the wonderful thinking going on about 21st century education with our local schools, if possible, something along the lines of beta testing. There are some Grady tools out there. Is that being promoted perhaps through Center for Teacher Learning Assessment here with our local school districts, something along the lines that a Silicon Valley might incur. We're not that far from Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Is Becky Rosenberg in the audience?
Mm-hmm. Here.
There she is. Let's give her the mic.
Is it my turn?
And one of the features of the grant that we had from Lumina was for us to be able to collaborate with community colleges, not with K-12. And you know, we have certainly embedded electronic resources and methods into what we've done in that collaboration. But it was specifically not a collaboration with K-12 for that particular project. So, you know, over a longer haul, we hope to do some of that.
I should add on that score that, you know, we are currently exploring the possibility of developing a cradle-to-career partnership in Monterey County in partnership with schools and social service agencies and philanthropic organizations. So that we can have the best possible collective impact in all of the different efforts that people are doing, a lot of times in separate silos. That I anticipate that as we get into that process, we are going to start, you know, getting more involved and taking more ownership in how our schools are doing. Our teacher preparation program will become more engaged with how our teachers are doing, and so that, you know, some of the things that you were asking us about doing, I think will start naturally emerging from that greater engagement in the process.
And there's one thing I wanted to add from my vantage point, which is that, so we were, in truth, a little slow on this at Lumina Foundation to understand that these collaborative efforts actually can dramatically accelerate progress on increasing attainment. By collaborative, what I mean is thinking about at the community level how you bring the K-12 system, the higher ed leaders, the civic leaders, the business leaders together, and fashioning a plan to meet our community needs, and then deploy the resources, whatever those resources might be, to actually solve that problem. We got into this a couple of years ago in a handful of communities that we were working in around Latino student success. And so we worked in a dozen different communities around the country, still working in a dozen different communities around the country where we've tried to engage in this. And what that work actually made us realize, and the work that President Ochoa and I have talked about around that started in Cincinnati around something called the Strive Initiative, all of these things are really geared towards understanding that people live and work and go to school mostly in communities. Right, and that, so the community level of engagement is really, really important. So part of our new strategic plan, this idea of engagement of people in that mobilization I was talking about at the level of communities and regions and metropolitan areas is a really significant part of our efforts. We have very ambitious goals to be working in not a dozen communities, but many, many dozens of communities over the next few years in order to be able to do exactly what you're talking about.
So if I could read between the lines, that suggests that if we develop a strong partnership model here, we might be looking for some support.
I was waiting for the grant pitch. it's late, actually. you know, we're looking at this on a national scale, so that's a possibility.
Excellent.
Yes.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could share with us some of the feedback you've gotten on the DQP. What parts seem to be really robust and resonating for people? What parts are you feeling need revision and refinement?
Yeah, I don't want to get into too much detail about what's worked and what hasn't, but I want to try to be responsive to your... And the reason I don't want to get into that is that the four core drafters are actually reviewing some of that feedback now, and we want to make sense of it in order to, and then be able to articulate back to all of you what we've learned. But I want to be clear, some of it's worked, some of it hasn't. And so the beta test has been affirmed in the sense that we didn't think we had it right. We've learned that core elements of this thing are working particularly well, but some elements are not working as well as others. And in particular, things are missing from it. And one area that I'll mention, because I've already been talking about this publicly, is that there's clearly an element of the DQP that needs significant strengthening around, I guess, what I would call global literacy, which is better being able to describe competencies around your ability to be an effective participant in the global context, an effective actor in the global context. So being able to effectively articulate some of these competencies around global literacy is going to be very important. This goes way beyond things like language capacity, but really a cultural awareness, ability to use examples from other contexts as a way of solving problems in the context that you're working with in, et cetera. Those are things that are clearly going to need to be wrestled with in the next version of the DQP.
You've been listening to the final Cal State Monterey Bay President Speaker Series with featured guest Jamie Marisotis of the Lumina Foundation. The question and answer session continues in the next audio file on this page.